Hey guys, welcome to the New York Film Academy Hour. Today we have special guest, the Chair of Community Outreach for the New York Film Academy in Los Angeles. Mason Richards is here today to talk about his film career, his favorite movies, and his approach to filmmaking. So stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Hey guys, I'm Joelle Smith. My co-host Pega is once again doing amazing things with her husband. I'm not jealous or angry, especially not today, because look at this guy across the table from me. Mason Richards, y'all don't know this, but Mason and I sit right next to each other in the office, so this is super exciting to have him in here talking to me about his film career. We're always talking about community stuff and social media and that fun stuff, but I never get to hear about your film career.
Right, yeah. Right. And it's interesting, like, that's why I'm, you know, there at New York Film Academy.
Yeah.
It's because of film. But I love the outreach. The community outreach is really important to me as well.
He's really good with people, y'all. Well, we always start with the same question. And our question is, when did you first know you were in love with movies?
When did I first know I was in love with movies?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't immediate, okay, right? It was a gradual process. I started out when I was very young in theater. I was part of a theater company in New York City called the City Kids Repertory Company. And it was a theater company in Tribeca that was about arts education. So it was for young people, by young people. And we basically workshopped issues that were important to us, like peer pressure, drug abuse, wow, all that stuff. And then we would write theater pieces and then perform them all over the city.
That's incredible.
So I started out, it was pretty amazing. I started out pretty much acting and doing theater, musical theater, and then I got into doing stuff off Broadway, et cetera, and film came later.
Okay, but talk about it. Like, when does film? Because I feel like either you're a Steven Spielberg who walked out of the womb, like, I'm going to be a director, or you're like a, oh my gosh, girlfriend who directed Mississippi Masala. Why can't I think of her name?
Oh, I'm spacing on her name too.
Y'all should know her. I should know her, yes. She's great, but she frequently, Mira Nair frequently talks about how she came to film so much later. She's a graduate at Harvard before she turns to film. And I find that process so interesting of when do people find film in their career. So when does it happen for you?
Well, I think filmmaking is an accumulation of a lot of things. And I think you have to, it's about storytelling. And I think you have to have stories to tell in order to make films. So, you know, it for me was a gradual process. After doing theater in New York as a kid, I went to college. I went to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and I studied not film, but I studied human and organizational development, which is like social psychology.
Yeah.
And I also double majored in English. So I studied the classics, you know, Shakespeare, the Romantics, poets, poetry, and all that stuff. So I was learning and how to work with people and how to understand human behavior. And I was also learning about about literature and writing and storytelling. So while I was at Vanderbilt, I got the bug to direct my first play.
Yeah.
My freshman year. So we got together, a few students got together, and we directed the very well-known play for colored girls who've considered suicide when the rainbow is an opposite.
If you haven't, Sang, so good.
Entejaki Shange. So if you haven't read this play or seen it, it's an amazing piece. It's all about empowerment of women, and it's a core poem. So like stories about women and their struggles, and this was done back in the 60s. It was, mm-hmm. So I directed this piece my freshman year at Vanderbilt.
Incredible.
And it was great. And so it was the first time I was on the other side of the stage sort of telling the actors what to do. And that's when I caught the bug, I think. That's when I realized, you know what? I think I like being on the other side and working with the actors as opposed to being one of the actors.
Does it matter to you now, theater play, whether it's on the stage play or if it's filmed? Or do you have a preference? Are you still directing stage plays or are you solidly in celluloid now?
I am all film right now, but I fantasize about directing a play. I love just the live energy of being in a theater space, because everything is in real time, and I love working with theater actors because it's a different process you go through when you're doing something in real time on the stage. So I miss that process.
Yeah.
But I think the same sort of skill set as a director you need for film, you need it from theater is the same thing. You know, understanding moments that are happening on with the overall story, mm-hmm. and then understanding moments that are happening with the characters and beats. It's all the same. It's just a mechanism that's a little different.
Yeah, I was shadowing Dimitri Moore when he was doing Trouble in Mind in Chicago, and it was interesting to me because I had studied. He taught a directing course, and that's where I met him, and I learned all this stuff about film, and we're talking about, like, framing and stuff and how to make sure actors are in the moment right there on set and creating an atmosphere in which them to work. Whereas when we're doing the play, he's like, just faster, faster, faster. There's a time. There are deadlines. And it was so much more about making sure the actors, because the repetition of it, it just started just dragging everybody down. And so I was trying to keep it fresh as opposed to trying to be in the moment. And I just found that really interesting as having to have both sets as a director to be able to do both. Sometimes at the same time.
Yeah. And the fundamental, that's a good story. I'm glad you said that, because the fundamental difference about with theater and film is sort of like the rehearsal process and the actual, you know, performance.
Yeah.
So in theater, you need a lot more time to rehearse and get it right, repetition, and you know your marks, mm-hmm. right? And so when it happens live, it's happening in the moment, but you have to know your marks. In film, you don't rehearse as much. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of, you know, talk to the actor and you talk about the backstory and you talk about the world of the film and the life of the character and the given circumstances, all those things, and then you wait for sort of film magic, they call it. You know, so when you say action, you want it to kind of be organic and real because the camera is so intimate and so in your face. You want the actor to kind of really be there in the moment. So they're two very different processes, but I love them both. You know, I love them both.
Absolutely, it's fun to work through both of them. I want to go back a little bit. So you're a kid. You're growing up in New York. You're writing and producing your own plays, and you're like workshopping them and sending them around, which is incredible work ethic for me to have, like, to imagine like little Mason, like, yeah, guys, we can do it.
Little Mason.
But then you moved to Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Was there culture shock in going from one to the other? Had you split your time before, or was it just like, holy cow, where am I?
Was there culture shock? Yes. Big time. Cause I grew up in Brooklyn. You know, I was born in South America. My family immigrated to Brooklyn, to Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. Old school Brooklyn back in the day, you know, it's gentrified a little bit now. So I grew up in New York. I grew up as a New Yorker, and I heard about this amazing scholarship to Vanderbilt University. And so I went for it, a full academic scholarship, merit leadership scholarship, and I won it. So it was a big moment for me and my family to be, you know, the first to go to college. Wow. And nonetheless, a school like Vanderbilt. And so I did experience culture shock because when I first got there, it was just it's the South. It's a different place. It's the Bible Belt, right? And, you know, the way people sort of navigate around race and identity is a little different. But I enjoyed my time there. I felt like the campus was very open in terms of the administration, in terms of diversity of the student body, and having conversations and being inclusive. There were some issues with some students. You know, we had to have conversations.
Because
people, it's interesting. When you go to a campus where people have different backgrounds and experiences, you just have questions.
Sure.
And you don't know. So I think there's a lot of people wondering, like, who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here?
Figuring
kind of
people
thing.
Out. What's happening? What's your backstory? Absolutely. It's interesting. So I went through the same kind of culture shock, but at a much younger age. I was born just outside of Chicago, but when I was 5, we moved to Ottawa, Illinois, which is the corn. Like, my backyard is essentially a state park. and I know that it greatly affected my art and how I approach the world. Like, the lenses through which I approach the world were affected by that change at a young age. It happened to you a little bit later, but I'm curious, did it affect your art? I mean, the first thing you put up was for Color Girls in the Bible Belt. So
yes. And actually, when we did for Color Girls at Vanderbilt, it was all over Nashville because it was the first ever African-American play in the history of the university at Vanderbilt. And and in Nashville, I don't think it was played there. So the Nashville Banner, the Tennessean, they did stories on me and us, you know, coming from New York and doing this.
Incredible.
And I think, to answer your question, when you're in a space where you feel like your voice is limited, you sort of go into a space of trying to speak up louder. So I think when I was a freshman at Vanderbilt, I was a little bit militant, a little bit like, you know, what about women? What about black rights? You know?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think most students, you know, like we know the show Dear White People that's on right now.
Yeah.
When you're in a college campus environment, everything is just sort of like enhanced. So I was very much into like showing my culture.
You know, we had Todd Leon on the show last week, and he did his film with Industry Lab, and he's, you know, saying the same things of, you know, being openly queer and coming from the Asian community and trying to bridge those gaps between history. And I feel like, I mean, if not in college, when do you do those things? Because exactly. Later you start to realize, like, I need a paycheck. I got to, like, reform a little bit. I got to figure out, when can I say these? Not that your belief systems change, but just how you deliver those messages.
Absolutely.
has to adjust to, you know, again, money. but, yeah, so I also wanted to talk to you about, well, where should we go from here? So, okay, let's talk about making that move from being on the stage to going behind the scenes. So I feel like as an actor, there's a lot of, okay, how do I make sure that I fit into this role and give my partners what they need on right. stage? And it's kind of a very solo project and then a team effort and then back to solo. And then, but when you're a director, it's all team. It's always reaching in. And it's not just, what can I do? It's how do I make sure everyone is getting to the same end goal? What was that transition like?
It was definitely a learning moment, because I think that, like, you're right. Like, I think as an actor, you're more concerned about your role and what you're doing and your intention. And as a director, you are in charge of the entire vision of the piece, of the film, or whatever the show is. So you have to wear a different hat. You have to be a caretaker. You have to be a leader. You have to be a nurturer. You have to be a great listener. And you have to think about everyone from the star of your film or the star of your play to craft services to, you know, everything. So I think it was definitely a learning curve to kind of realize what skills I needed to be a director. And it didn't happen right away. I think after I directed for Color Girls and I did some other plays at Vanderbilt, when I graduated, I wanted to learn more about the business industry and learn. And so I worked corporately. I worked at CBS News in New York and doing some journalism and marketing to kind of figure out the leadership part.
Because you hadn't worked enough jobs yet.
Because I didn't work enough.
Still figuring out.
And my parents were like, wait, you went to Vanderbilt. You should become a lawyer or a doctor. Mm-hmm. Why do you want to be a filmmaker? Why do you want to be an artist? I'm sure a lot of students can relate to that.
I certainly can.
Right? It's because it's, you know, I worked corporately. I worked in the industry, you know, at CBS and Paramount for a little bit to kind of learn the business and develop my skills as a leader. And then I left those jobs, waited tables in LA, and then decided to go to film school and, you know, focus on my craft as a filmmaker. So it was like a process, you know, and over years to kind of be where I'm at right now.
So I know you, when you started wanting to tell stories, you started with women and people of color and queer communities, all that's handled in for Color Girls. When you moved to film, what were the first kind of stories that you were telling? Are you on the same path? What were you kind of exploring as you entered the film industry?
That's a great question. Let me think back. You know, I think it was the same. You know, I think you always, I think as a filmmaker, as artists, I think we do our best work when we're honest and truthful about our own experiences and the experiences in the communities we're from, right? I just grew up in that space with arts education and, you know, identity and letting the world know who you are, that kind of thing, and exploring who you are. So a lot of my first films, when I went to grad school at CalArts, I focused on identity, about characters trying to find themselves, characters who were... exploring new realities, characters exploring their identity, things like that. So I wasn't as concerned about the technical aspects of filmmaking when I was in grad school, but I was more concerned with what messages do I want to share with the world? What stories do I think are important to tell the world?
See, and I've always viewed myself as a storyteller too, and I know that caused a lot of issues at my film school, which is a very practical, hands-on film school, where they were like, okay, it's really great that you have crafted these beautiful characters. Do you know, like, what camera you're using? And I was like, I don't care about any of those things.
Right, right.
I, like, as long as my DP knows what they're doing, I felt like I was good. Now, I later learned why you need to learn all these things,
yes.
That having a well-rounded education helps you make smarter decisions in the moment. But I'm curious as to how you managed that as you're moving into the technical aspects of filming, whereas on stage, you know, you do need to know lights and you need to know technical right. positions and things. There's aspects of it, but right. film is an entirely different beast.
Right. Well, don't get me wrong. Like, we had very intensive, I was in a master's program, MFA program, in very intensive classes on film. I learned to shoot on 35 millimeter cut film with razor blade on a flatbed. And I learned sound, all the full production. Mm-hmm. But I think the focus, was a bit different about in terms of me developing myself as an mm-hmm. artist and the voice I want to have as an artist. And I think it's important as a filmmaker to have both. You need to have that double consciousness where you are very much aware of the technology because it's rapidly changing, and knowing how you want to show your tell your story, what style, the technical stuff is really important, but it's also important to know that part. So finding a way to connect those two is really important. And I think that it's important for, if you're a filmmaker, if you love film, to figure out what you're best at. Mm. It's really important to figure out what am I best at, and how can I really cultivate that in a school environment. Some people are amazing in sound. Some people are amazing in production design, right? Some people are amazing in cinematography. But you have to find that. And I think if we all gravitate towards directing, and because it seems fun, it's glamorous,
I can remember going to school and they were being like, okay, so guys, if you have any desire to do sound, buy some sound equipment and get started. You will be the first ones to have jobs. And damn it if they weren't correct.
Yep.
Every sound person I know hired instantly. Yep. If you have a basic sound kit and the abilities to get a clean recording, you're instantly employable, and a lot of those guys go on to have all kinds of careers just because they were there first.
Joelle, that's real talk.
Yeah,
that's real talk. Yes,
it's absolutely real talk. I don't begrudge anyone who is again like me, and I'm just like, I just want to work with the actors, and like, then right. I talk to my DP, and I'm like, I like that framing. Okay, right. good, and then I'm good to go. Like, did production design show up? Great.
Exactly.
But I am really intrigued at your process of making films. Mm-hmm. So are you writing your scripts, or are you mostly working off of other people's?
I'm a writer director, and I proudly say that, that hyphen writer director, because I write all of my work. As an English major and as a writer, and it's just natural for me to sort of write the stories. I have directed films that scripts were given to me, mm-hmm. but that's my thing. Like, I like the process of having an idea and then developing that into a script, right? And then seeing it through pre-production, production, and post, and then sharing it with the world. So I write all of my stuff.
Man, I have a lot of auteurs in here, just people who are like, yeah, start to finish. Like, I know what I want, and I know what I'm going after. And I feel like that's half the struggle of being a director, mm-hmm. is just having the, not just the thought, but the confidence in the thought to make sure that it gets seen through to its fruition. Let's talk a little bit about your artistic style. Who inspires you cinematically?
That's a tough question, Joelle. I'm sure I'm not the first director to say this. It's challenging when you ask a director who's a favorite, who's you influence you, because there's so many.
Yeah.
I'm influenced by so many filmmakers. But right off the top of my head, right now in this moment with you, Terrence Malick is one of my favorites. He did Tree of Life and a bunch of other films. And the reason why I say him, because he is an amazing visual storyteller, and he's an amazing collaborator that works well with cinematography to tell a story. Like, all of his films, you're sort of in the character and in the world of the film, right? And he does that by the choices he makes in terms of the camera lenses, the movement, and his relationship with the cinematographer.
If you guys haven't seen a Terrence Malick film, anytime you've seen like Wheat Field, where the sun is catching the rays on the wheat and the camera's kind of swaying there, that's Terrence Malick that.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And so, and I also love, I love international filmmakers. Like, I'm influenced by an Indian filmmaker actually from the 50s, Sajid Ray. He did these films called the Apu Trilogy. And it's sort of a film shot in his village. And it's just the simplicity and just the simple craftsmanship of just the shot composition and the depth of the stories. I love his work. I also love Abbas Kiarostami, who's an Iranian filmmaker, who, if you don't know who that is, you got to check him out. he did an amazing film called Where's My Friend's Home that shot in Iran. And it was a film that it told a story about this little boy trying to find his friend's house to get his homework, right? Yeah. But within that, Abbas Kiarostami was able to craft this world of Iran that I could have never even imagined, and shared his town with us in the style of the way it was shot. And it's just brilliant filmmaking. So yeah, those are my top two. And I also love Juan Carl Y and a bunch of international.
I don't know why, but I wanted to say Pedro Almodovar would be in there, yeah, of course, for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we can keep going. Yeah.
Just his bright colors, and he kind of has an unflinchingness that I'd agree with you. Why? Okay. So I called you an auteur a little bit earlier because you seem to have a strong sense of what you want out of a film, start to finish, your hands on. Do you consider yourself an auteur? Do you buy into the theory?
Yes. I consider myself an artist. Like, when people ask me who am, I say I'm an artist because since I remember, I was always creating things, you know? I like to create and write, and I see things, you know, I have the artistic eye where I see things in color and I hear music, and I think it's all connected. And so I'm an artist. You know, I was telling someone recently when I was in New York for the show opening that I wanted to, when I was in the sixth grade, I wrote, when you graduated, you wrote what you wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I wrote, I wanted to be a photographer and a journalist. Like, both of those, right? And it's interesting, like,
so
full circle.
So image and story just constantly there with you. That's kind of amazing. What kind of journalist did you want to be? Did you know? Had you thought that far into it? Or were you just like, I just want to be a reporter?
I didn't know. I just want to be a reporter. It just seemed fun. It seemed fun. Like, they were able to travel places and a camera. They always seemed cool, you know?
Definitely. So. Now, journalists always seem like they have it together. Can you tell us a little bit about your latest project?
The latest project. Okay. Well, I'm working on the feature version of my short film, The Seawall, which was, it's sort of, In a way, this has turned into like my opus in a weird way, because it's like the story you got to tell. So The Seawall is a short film that I made at CalArts. It's my thesis film.
Okay.
It's a story about a boy who gets a visa to move away from his home country in Guyana, South America, to go to America to be with his mom. So he lives with his grandmother. So the story is about this grandmother and his grandson dealing with the separation as he prepares to go off to his new life in America.
My goodness.
Yeah, so... it's a 9-minute short that is sort of autobiographical in a lot of ways. I was born in Guyana in South America, and my family immigrated to New York when I was 7 years old. And so the story sort of looks at that. This is the one that's on exhibit currently in New York City.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. So tell us a little bit, like, why now tell the story? I mean, you did it, the short, while you're still in school, and now you're expanding into a feature. What's kind of driving that?
I think the reception of it. So I've completed the short in 2010, and it was in many film festivals. It premiered in the Cannes Film Festival in France. It played in the Havana Film Festival in Cuba. So I was there, and Cuba's amazing. It played all over Europe, in London, and all over the Caribbean, the Bahamas, at the Island House, and a bunch of places. And I kept getting people who wanted to have this conversation about immigration and about identity, because, you know, the subject matter of the film is about leaving your birth country and going to another place for a better life, and what it does to families as they separate. And I think it's something that's unresolved with me. I still feel like I was uprooted from my country, you know, to America. As amazing as America is, I still feel like... there's something missing back there with me. And so the reception of The Seawall, the short, was so great that we decided to work on the feature. So I spent the past few years finishing the feature screenplay, finally. I should get an award for that. And we're in pre-production right now. So I have an amazing team, amazing executive producers, and we're finalizing our cinematographer, and we're going to go back to Guyana to shoot. And the story's bigger. I realized after making a 9-minute short film that I wanted to show more about the country and expand a little more. So I, you know, the story's now about the adult character going back to his home country to find him, his identity and self, and ultimately his father. So it's a film about fatherhood and coming into one's own. So
let's dig into that. So when you start, it's a kid and his grandmother, and he's got the visa, and they're kind of dealing with about how they're about to be separated, but also about how they're about to take on this new kind of challenge and this new life, which is really exciting. How do you then, is that the intro for the feature, or did you kind of just like, look, these are the inspirations, it's semi-autobiographical, and I'm just going to start from scratch but keep those same core ideas?
It's actually the same title, the same name, and part of the short is in the feature. So I basically expanded the story.
Okay.
So if you think about it, like, I made this short because I left Guyana when I was 7, and I didn't go back until I was in grad school, in film school. I went back for the first time 20 plus years later, and I was shocked. I was shocked because the memories that I had as a kid, the visuals I had as the country, was completely different. And then when I got there, I stayed at my grandmother's house, the house I was born in, I grew up in, and memories start to come back, and images and stories. So I was inspired to write that story. And so with the feature, it's sort of like, you know, you have like I have this unresolved story that I need to tell and share with the world. But the thing that's important for me is that I take my time to do it properly, you know. So that's where we're at, following the older character and going back home.
That's amazing. No, you totally. What was different? You said when you went back, it was different than what your memories had held. What had changed, or what was different, or what were you misremembering?
Well, you know, as a kid, our memory, you know, we see the world as a beautiful, fantastic place, right? We take time to notice the colors and, like, the birds and flowers and, you know, beauty and water and swimming and fun things, right? And I remember my childhood in Guyana being very magical, like going along the seawall, you know, and which is right off the Atlantic Ocean. It's a beautiful man-made structure, and just, you know, Guyana is part of the Amazon, and just being in nature, and I just remember all of that. And moving to New York, it was a harsh reality. It was like, you're in Brooklyn, it's winter, you have to get a coat, you know.
I'd be like, it's winter.
It's winter.
Which, if you've survived one of those, you know exactly what he's talking about.
Exactly. So what was different is that I went back as an adult, and I realized how underdeveloped the country was, and how, you know, the resources were gone, and a lot of places were run down, and a lot of people had left the country. Guyana became independent in 1966 from Britain. It was a British colony, and then a lot of the educated class and just a lot of people just fled the country. So when you go back now, it just kind of it looked when I went back then, it looked empty and abandoned a little bit. There are actually more Guyanese people living outside of the country than in the country. It's a population of about 750,000 people who are a mixed race, who are Afro-Guyanese with African heritage like me, who had look black. And then a large part of the population in Guyana is Indian, from India.
Wow.
And people don't know this, about 53% of the population from India. So after, you know, slavery was abolished in Guyana, indentured servants were brought in from India, New Delhi, mainly women. And so the culture, the Guyanese culture, is this hybrid of India and Africa, and we have Amerindian, like native people, and the Chinese culture, Dutch and Portuguese. So it's this beautiful tapestry. And so going back, I saw it differently. And I remember my best friend growing up across the street from me was Indian. And I just didn't know, I didn't even think about it.
Right, that's just who he was.
Friends.
Yeah.
And so in the feature film of The Seawall, I'm getting more into that, showing that history, that connection with India. Guyana is referred to sometimes as Little India because, you know, the culture. And I grew up eating curries and, you know, and it's a really beautiful place. And so the feature is just me spending more time with that story and being an auteur and sharing more of that with
this
everybody.
Sounds fascinating. I love learning about other cultures, and I know, like, next to squat about Guyanese culture, so I'm really excited to watch the film. No, seriously, because I feel like this is the best way to inform a mass public about a place, is to have someone from that space tell their stories. And I know you have this incredible run of, like, I mean, you're a community outreach director, but you're also are actively engaging in social political activism like frequently. I know one of the things he does with young storytellers and encouraging kids from all different kinds of neighborhoods, especially kids who maybe wouldn't have access to the tools in order to tell their own stories, to do that. And I'm curious as to what drove you. This is before you come to NYFA, you're already engaged in these activities. So what brings you to community service?
Well, I believe that service is very important. Community service is very important. And I, more importantly, believe that arts education is important in giving back. And I think when you have young people that don't have access to resources to tell their story, I think that's a problem. I think that it's a problem when arts education funding is being cut in this country. Mm. It's a problem when schools don't have computers for kids. So I think it's important, you know, the arts is one way for those communities to share their stories and experiences. I mean, if we are to be a more inclusive country. So I've done, and that's from, like, we started this conversation talking about me growing up and doing theater. I was a benefit of that. Like, I had mentors, you know, growing up. Isaiah Washington, the actor, was one of my mentors in City Kids. Jamal Joseph, who is a Columbia University former Black Panther. I was 12 years old, 13, 14, around these people who were giving of their time to me, to encourage me, to be examples, you know, of what you can do with the arts. So the work I do with New York Film Academy and community outreach, and the work I do with Young Storytellers Foundation, even with BAFTA and all the, you know, the great organizations, and Hands for Hope LA, it's about me giving back of myself, and us sort of creating a space for those young people to have the similar opportunities that I had, you know, to become an artist. Because I think it's not encouraged or promote as much from certain communities to pursue Korean arts, because it can be expensive. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, and then there's always this large looming myth, especially over poor families. Like mine, where my parents were like, okay, but how are you going to get a job? Like, we don't care what you do, really, but you're never going to work as an artist. And I had to work really hard to prove to them, like, there are thousands of jobs out here that fall under arts. Yes. They're not all glamorous, and they're not all going to pay you incredibly well, but you can ink out a living if you hustle.
And you're doing it, Joelle. You're in
living
and
that life.
You know what I mean? You know what I tell students as well too is that you live it. In the arts, it's also about finding a community of artists, right? And it's also about finding your tribe.
Yeah.
If you're a storyteller, you're a creative person. You like films. You like photography. You like sculpting. You like animation. Find your tribe. Find your people. Find your community. And you know, it's a place. You know, there are many jobs in there. And you find your place. And I think it's important for young people to know they have access to that.
Absolutely. So let's talk about access to your latest film, The Seawall. Where is this playing at?
Okay, great. So The Seawall short film. Mm-hmm. It's I'm so excited about this, Joelle. I was just in New York last week. There's an amazing new museum in Harlem.
Yes.
Harlem, USA, on the east side. It's called the Caribbean Cultural Center African Diaspora Institute.
Yes.
The CCCADI. CCCADI, right? So it's Caribbean culture and African culture all in one place. It used to be an old firehouse that they converted. You know, New York is good for that.
You know, it's lovely then.
It's amazing.
Say, old churches and old firehouses always make the best apartments.
And it's a great
showcase space, yes.
Yeah, so the old firehouse converted into an art gallery. There's a couple stories.
Amazing.
And there's an amazing curator. Her name is Grace Ali, who's also a Guyanese woman, who curated this amazing piece. So there's 16 artists, painters, Guyanese painters, textile artists, photographers and sculptors on this exhibit. So if you go down there to the museum, you can really check out some interesting art that sort of tells the story of our experiences in Guyana and also in America. So my film is the only film, The Seawall is the only film installation there. So once you go in, you can sit down and watch the 9-minute short.
That's amazing.
So it's running. It's important. It's running until October. October 26th. So if you're in New York City, go to the museum and spend an afternoon in Harlem, USA.
Yes.
And check out the exhibit.
Historic Harlem is beautiful. And there's always great things just to kind of see on the street yes. before you even get to your destinations. Curious, did you sit through a screen? Okay, well, first of all, okay, several questions. One, do they play the movie on a loop or is it, I freaking love that. I love going because I love not knowing when I'm coming into a movie and then trying to figure out where the beginning is. I did that. There was one, the Art Institute of Chicago had a, they built up a new modern wing in their museum and they had a video called Broken Glass that's about 23 minutes of just glass breaking.
Wow.
Yeah, it becomes overwhelming at some point, especially because it's just a dark room. Mm-hmm. You just walk in and out and it just plays on a loop. It never stops. It never ends. You have no idea where you are in the time of the movie, in the narrative. And so you're left to kind of piece it out and put it together yourself. Yeah. I just like the idea a lot of coming in. So you watch the film. Did you get to watch it with an audience? And if so, what is that experience like?
I did. And it's always good to watch the film. But it's always good to watch the film with an audience because I get to feel the energy and feel the moments where, you know, they're connecting or not.
Yeah.
It was interesting when the Seawall, the same short that's playing at the museum, when it played in Havana Film Festival a couple of years ago, I was actually there. And I translated the film into Spanish, Spanish subtitles. And it's called the Seawall. And in Cuba, in Havana, they have a seawall, which is a man-made structure that prevents the country from flooding. And it's, you know, it's on the coast. In Cuba, in Havana, they call it El Malecón. So they knew seawall. So there was a line around the block to watch my little film in Havana.
Wow.
People wanted to see the story about a seawall in a different country in South America. And I sat in the screenings and just, even though the language was different, it was English and Spanish subtitles, just seeing the connection, like people were able to connect to the story. And it just made me feel like, great, like this is, it's valuable and I need to do more and share, you know, more of the story because people are connecting with it so much.
It's cool to see films be global in their reach. I feel like, not to disparage streaming or Netflix or anything, these are great tools that give easy access to a ton of material. But, I mean, to me, watching film is a lot of it, the value is sitting in a room with other people and having a shared experience in these projected images. So it's really cool that you got to screen in Havana.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And then now in Harlem, what's the difference like between those two audiences?
You know what? There wasn't much difference because, you know, because the people that came, because I stayed there in Harlem last week, I stayed and spoke to people afterwards. And Joelle, like, I kid you not, people were coming up and they were saying, oh, the film is great. The film is good. You know, I was like, thank you. You know. But what they, more importantly, what they wanted to talk about was their story. They wanted to share with me and say, hey, I can relate to that character because my family left or this person, you know, left or I left. You know, a woman, someone in New York told me last week that their family, when they immigrated to the U.S. from Guyana, it was by night. They were so young. The family said, okay, tomorrow we're leaving. So there's no preparation time. And I found out, like, that's very common in migration and in immigration. And that's what the exhibit looks at. You know, like, there's, like, an uproot and a décollage of you have to remove from one place and something happens with you. So people wanted, you know, to come up to me and tell me their story about leaving, how they had to leave Guyana or they never went back, which is very common, and why they want to go back. And so I think I think that's important. That's always important as a filmmaker to be able to understand what the connection is with the audience and your story. And it really made me feel like, you know, this is a universal story and people can relate to it, which is even more energy that I'm pushing into the feature.
Did you feel a change in yourself at all after completing the short? Because, I mean, that's a lot of kind of emotional baggage to unpack into a film. And I'm curious if you were like, if you felt you got something out that was really important, or if you discovered anything about yourself through that process?
Joelle, that's a great question. And I was just talking to someone about this the other day. I had a meeting with the producer because we're trying to get some additional funding for the feature. Sure. So it's talking about the film, and the producer asked me that same question. And from the gut, from the real place, I said, you know, I believe that the arts is didactic, like it's dyadic. It's between two people, you know. It's about the artist telling a story and working through something for themselves, right? But it's also to share something with an audience. And I think with the short, I was in grad school. I went to tell a story. I went to go back home, explore my history, my identity, my family story, and I feel like I got that work done. Like I found a lot, I answered a lot of questions about, some unanswered questions about my childhood growing up and my father and, you know, all that stuff. And, you know, what it meant to leave my country. And then even working on the feature screenplay, Joelle, I realized that I was able to work through a lot of those issues, and understand my family, my father, my mother, and the sacrifice they made for us. I was able to understand my grandfather's journey and understand the journeys of my ancestors and just researching all of that. And then it became a point where I was like, okay, I'm the artist and I'm getting something out of it. And then almost like my soul just opened up and I was like, you know what, now is the time to share this with the world. And so people can have another experience so they can begin to investigate some of those unanswered questions, you know, because I think art is about that. It's about exploring ourselves and exploring who we are as human beings. And it's about humanity. And so, it did change. You know, initially the short was about me exploring and telling the story that I wanted to tell for me and work through my stuff. But then as the project got more momentum and started traveling around the world, and the more feedback I got from people, just random people. I get emails from people in Egypt and Ethiopia and in different countries relating, connecting to it. And so then I realized this is bigger, you know, and art is about creating something bigger to, you know, to share that story with the world.
So, okay, you've created, I'm going to call it a conversation piece, a space where people whose stories aren't frequently told kind of get to explore and retell their stories through your story, because now they're connecting it with their families and friends, and I'm sure sharing, like, you have to see this thing because it's like what we went through. Mm-hmm. Now that you're kind of starting to have that impact, and as you move into your feature version of it, what is your headspace like? Because you captured it with kind of a kid and a grandma, and I feel like those are very eternal, and now you're going into much broader themes, and it's pre-production, which for me is always a fuzzy, crazy space of like all of the possibilities and trying to remember the reality of money. There's so many things we could do, but we have to pick one and just go. Yeah. So that's kind of not a very good question, Joelle.
You're setting me up nicely.
Yeah. What's your headspace like, and how are you feeling heading into production, I guess?
I must say, this is probably one of the most challenging things I've ever taken on in my life. Like doing your first feature, and it is my first feature. And, you know, I feel like I've been talking about it for a long time, and I've been preparing for a long time, because I believe it's that important to me. You know, I'm a huge fan of Barry Jenkins, who, you know, did Moonlight and won the Oscar for Moonlight. And, you know, he made his first film, Medicine for Melancholy, I'm forgetting the year, like, 8 years
back
ago,
back in the day,
sort of. His first film, and it did well. It was a beautiful film. If you haven't seen it, Medicine, check it out. And it took him 8 years, six plus 8 years, to work on his second feature because he wanted to take the time to, like, cultivate that story and, you know, and take the space to know your beats and know your motif, you know.
It pays off
all your
so
stuff.
Beautifully.
And it pays off.
Because if you guys don't know, if you've seen Moonlight, you don't know, the third act essentially was written by Barry Jenkins. He got the play, he read it, loved it because it was great, but he knew that it needed it wasn't quite finished, and so he wrote this beautiful third act that kind of uplifts and brings everything together, and the payoff is 8 years, but that end result can't be denied. So I hear what you're saying. You want to be like, look, I only have one chance really to tell this story, you know, you don't want to be rehashing the same things over and over again. And so I totally understand why. So that's where
I'm at. I'm in a Barry Jenkins space where I'm just sort of like, where I'm sort of like, okay, I'm going to wait and do it right. And so because, and you know, fun in reality of being in production as a filmmaker is funding, you know, trying to get funding together, getting cast together. So we're doing all of that. And then reworking the story, you know. One thing I did that I'm really proud of recently, I had a table read. So I casted a bunch of actors and we read the script and I was able to hear it out loud. And I really recommend that for filmmakers. Mm. A lot of people were sort of like, oh, you had a table read. That's, people don't do that often. But I think it's the best thing because you really get to hear the characters and hear the story and it helps formulate your visuals as a director. And, you know, I think of filmmaking as a craft. It's not like, let's just get it done. So I'm taking all the steps. I'm writing the script, pre-production, you know, now in pre-production and preparing, you know, with casting and getting my crew together. We're doing location scouting soon in Guyana. So it's just a whirlwind. It's going really fast and slow at the same time. But I'm really excited. I'm guided by something greater, I think. I think my grandfather, my ancestors are just like, you got to tell the story. You got to do it right. Which years ago, that was like a pressure. It was like a burden. Like, I have to make sure everybody's happy and the film is great. But I think now it's more about just telling the truth as I know it for the characters and the film.
I was going to ask you, because it is such a personal story, and you are taking over a lot of the main jobs on the film, and I always feel that it's important that I, at some point, hand my story over to someone because I need second eyes. I need somebody who's like, girl, no one's going to know where your headspace is here. Like, come back this way so that your thoughts are properly communicated. Right. Do you at any point give up your story or are you just like, no, I'm not you, girl. I got it.
No, I think filmmaking is very collaborative to me. Extremely collaborative. And I think even though it's sort of my story, you know, when I was doing the writing process, I had five readers. So I would write, you know, the first, you know, 30 pages and I had five people giving me notes and first draft of the film. I would get notes and I would sit and with them and I trusted these people, you know, I trusted them for their storytelling abilities and their past work. And so I was able to look at their notes and sort of like spend time with them and think about what do I want to do? Because I think they represented different voices. So I collaborate on that aspect. I'm open with that, you know, process. And I think as a filmmaker, it's really important to be open to hear feedback and notes, especially if it's your story, because you could be in your own head and you think it's the bomb and it's amazing, and then it's like, wait, but you forgot about this whole.
It's easy to be distracted. You end up in the post, and they're like, "So how do we get from this scene to this scene?" I don't know. We did not get there in the production process.
Yes, or you could forget about voices, you know, and like I'm all about being inclusive and. And in filmmaking, there's a whole lot of conversation right now in Hollywood about diversity and being inclusive. Mm-hmm. And I think that even in my script, I realized that I was forgetting some textures of the female characters and of our Indo-Guyanese characters. And I was reminded by that by notes from the people that I had read with me. And so I was able to go back and do the research and get the work done, you know, to be more inclusive.
I really appreciate that conversation. Well, seriously, because a lot of people, you know, we ain't got to call nobody out on the show, but we've certainly seen people recently in the news who are like, you know, I don't know how to tell these stories, so I just didn't. I don't have space for these stories, so I'm not going to. which always confuses me, because if the people were there, then their stories were happening, and we've seen hundreds of really solid films that tell congruent stories without pulling focus from your main narrative. So I don't know if I necessarily buy that, and it's really refreshing to hear a director or anyone in the filmmaking process say, I was out of my depth, so I had to reach out and make sure that I was giving the fullness that the story required so I could tell the best possible story. I don't want to ask that.
Uh-oh.
Well, no, it's not problematic or messy at all. But like when you're getting these notes, I know that sometimes it can be hard to hear or take notes, or especially, and you know, I don't know, you know, it's because both from the creative perspective, but also as a teacher, you're constantly giving out notes and things, and especially for I think early filmmakers, how do you tell the difference between a note that is good and maybe just isn't right for your story versus a note that is bad and something that you don't want to use at all? Well, how do you make these choices of like which ones to implement and which ones to exclude?
That's a great question. So as a professor, I have this conversation with students all the time, and I think sometimes when you're younger, it's maybe challenging to, you know, take in notes and feedback, and you sort of take it personally and think that this person is trying to mess me up, whatever. Here's what I think. Well, when I talk about notes, I think that if you're writing a script or you create some kind of work, right? You as the auteur, the artist, must know what your meta, your overall sort of goal is, or you know, what story you're trying to tell. That's the meta, right? And then if someone is giving you notes, they're giving you about your story. You just have to check in with, I'm trying to tell this story. How does that note relate to what they're saying, right? And then you create like a third space and try to see if you can answer that honestly.
Use
them, right? But I think what people do is that they feel like I'm getting a note and it's not what I want to do and it's going to sway my story. So the important thing is knowing your story and knowing your characters, and then you can filter those notes, right? And filter what they're saying. And the main thing, don't take it personally.
Yeah.
You know, it's you think that you hope that it is for the ultimate good of the story to make it more universal. So, you know, you can always try the note, you can always discard the note, but it's important to be open and receptive of notes.
Definitely. Oh man, I feel like we have time for one more question. I want to make it a good one.
Make it a good one.
No pressure there.
No gossip. I don't do gossip. No, nothing gossip.
Okay, here we go. I want to know how you go about curating teams. I know some members of your team are old friends, are people that you've worked with consistently. Mm-hmm. But how do you, the director, go about curating and developing like a sense of team spirit on set?
Well, first of all, I think that when you're putting together a creative team for a film, or you're hiring crew or producer, you have to, because we're human beings, you have to consider the person's technical proficiency, whatever it is, if they're a production designer or DP, know what they're good at, what they're doing. But I think it's also important to understand the kind of person they are, to get to know, even your actors, to know what kind of people they are, because you're going to be spending a lot of time together in small spaces filming. So I really try to, like, I'm dealing with that now, like, meet with people and for my main crew, and I think it's about having an organic connection and trying to make sure that you see the story in a similar plane or in a way that you can complement each other to make it amazing, right?
Yeah.
So I think it starts with the hiring process and building your team. And then, so when you're on set, you all have the shared vision, the same goal, which is ultimately making an amazing story, you know. So I think that's sort of the process, like finding out the sort of humanity, the intentions of the people that who are going to be making this thing, because you're all creating it together.
Absolutely.
So that's how I go about
that.
It.
Mason, this has been so much fun. I feel like I've learned so much about you and your artistic expressions and how you make films. I know you're about to be in production for this film, and that's probably your main focus. But is there anything coming up or anything like anyone should be looking out for if they want to follow your work?
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It was great to talk to you on this in a different, you know.
It's a very different
aspect. The cameras are here. There's all these people. There's a big audience. And I'm a little camera shy, but it was good. It's good to have a conversation with you. So I'll come back if you want me to come back.
Yes, please.
But really quickly, I really encourage people to check out the short. I have people writing me and people asking, my students are asking, when can I see your short? You can watch it online, the Seawall short film online at AnansiStudios.com.
Nice. So if you're watching American Gods, you already know the spelling. Get it together.
There you go. And just click the Seawall, the Seawall film by Mason Richards, and you can watch it for the price of a cup of coffee.
Nice.
I'll say that much. But what I'm also working on, I have my own production company that I started while I was at film school. I produce many documentaries to not-for-profits. I'm also working on doing some branded content for different clients. So I do that as well. I'm also developing a couple of TV pilots. I have some ideas, mainly, again, with stuff that's connected to me, like to Brooklyn. I have a film series about gentrification. And I have a couple things in the works that I hope to, you know, do as well. But check out the Seawall short, and I hope people stay with me for the journey as you make the feature. And we're on Facebook as well, Seawall Feature Film on Facebook.
Go follow Mason. Follow Seawall. Check out these films.
What about Instagram? People do that?
Instagram.
I'm so not in tune with the social media, but I am Mason Richards. That's my handle, title, what is it? On Instagram. And there's some cool photos up there I put up in my travels, so you can check that out.
I'm trying to see if I can tell you guys quickly who next week's guest is. What is it? Is it next week the 6th? No, it's the 28th.
Next week is, yes.
I don't remember. That's cool. You guys can come back here next week anyway, because we have another great filmmaker here to talk to you guys about their process, about new technologies, about how we're pushing forward. Thank you once again to Mason Richards for being here and sharing all of your wonderful wealth of knowledge and your original stories. It's really fascinating to talk to you. We'll be back here next week at 4 o'clock. All right. Hope to see you here.
Great. Bye. Thank you. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.